This is the most important thing I own right now, my watch. My name's Mac, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm absolutely delighted to be here. You know, so many people have come up to me this morning to ask me if I'm nervous, and I am nervous, but I've been asked so many times, I'm starting to wonder what you all know that I don't know. I hope there aren't going to be any surprises in the course of the next few minutes. I'd like to start by thanking Marie for asking me to come down. I was so flattered when she called, and I've thought about this several times before I got here, that how nice it was to just to be invited. It's nice to be asked to be anywhere, and I did. It is also humbling to know that in order to be invited to participate in a meeting like this, you have to make a mess of things first, and I certainly did, and I'll tell you about that in just a few minutes. I'd also like to thank Hollis. I've really enjoyed the chance to get to know him as well. And Bob, for meeting me at the airport and for the time we've had together. Ben and Charlie, who are in church this morning, were also shared with Bob responsibility for the corpus, and I've been well treated, and I've just had a wonderful weekend. And most of all, I want to thank all of you for being here this morning, especially those of you who are new. They say if you want to know if something is living, you look for evidence of growth, and that's why the new people are the most important people in this fellowship, because if AA doesn't grow, if something ever happens to AA, I'm going to be in a lot of trouble. My life, I had my last drink on the 8th of February in 1977. It was my most recent drink. I hope it was my last drink. And my life had gotten so bad that I had to call AA. And that's why I'm here this morning. If you want to know how bad your life can get, that's as bad as it can get if you have to call AA. You know, I so much wanted to go to the Kiwanis or the Rotary or the Church or the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or just about anybody else for help, but it got so bad that I had to call AA. My home group, I've heard a lot of talk this weekend about specialty groups. Or special interest groups. My home group was called the Creative Arts Group, and it was started by a group of people who across the street from a theater, and they were actors. And I've been, and I'm not an actor, by the way, but I've been a member of this. It's been my home group for some years now. And to the best of my knowledge, there's not a single representative of the performing arts in that group these days. But we have a great meeting. We meet on Wednesday nights at 7:30. It's a closed discussion meeting, and if you ever find your way up to Washington, I hope you'll come join us on Wednesday night. Well, like Brenda, I didn't aspire to be an alcoholic. That was not a career objective of mine. I grew up in a little town in southwestern Ohio. But I should mention two more things before I get started, though. One is I said I was an alcoholic, and while I'm not a performing artist, I am a liar, and it's real hard for me to talk for 20 minutes without telling a lie, and I'm going to tell a lie sometime between now and when I sit down, and I have no idea what it'll be, but I'll probably take a tape home to prove to my wife that I was here, and she'll play the tape, and I'll go, that wasn't true. And it's not my intent to lie to you this morning, but I have no doubt that I will. And I should mention, too, I usually give three talks, and probably some of you do, too. There's the talk before the meeting, and there's the talk at the podium, and then there's the talk afterward. And of the three, the third talk is definitely the best. So if you don't get anything out of what I say this morning, and you're interested in riding to the airport to hear the third talk, you're more than, I don't know how many people Bob has room for, but you're more than welcome to come out to the airport and hear the third talk. I grew up in a little town in southwestern Ohio called Hamilton. I met somebody from Cincinnati yesterday. Cincinnati's is a big town with small town charm. And I grew up in a small town with big city problems, Hamilton, Ohio. And I was the first born of five children to good alcoholic parents. I came from alcoholic stock on both sides. I was not a pioneer in the quest for degradation that is alcoholism, but I was the first of five, and my earliest memories from my childhood are of listening to my parents quarrel, and specifically listening to my mother quarrel, and my father listened to my mother quarrel. And the angrier she got, the less he talked, and the less he talked, the angrier she got. And by the time I was 4 or 5 years old, I figured out, and I'm sure some of you in this room have had the same experience, I figured out what was wrong. What was wrong was me. And at the age of 4 or 5, I had already figured out that if I hadn't been born, Mom and Dad wouldn't be angry, there wouldn't be conflict, there wouldn't be drinking, there wouldn't be any problems in our family, and it was my fault. As I said, there were five of us all together. I don't think I ever blamed the other four, but it was me. It was all my fault. And my mother was a very angry person, and it manifested itself in many ways. One of the ways was in the kitchen. I had to chuckle when Herb was talking the other night about how to make toast. That's my mother's recipe for toast. You put bread in the toaster, and when you smell smoke, you take it out and stand over the sink and scrape it. And that's how I've stayed sober for 20 years. It's a burn and scrape operation. I still tend to live my life that way. But my mother was very, very unhappy and very angry. And I went off to school, kindergarten and first grade. And as a youngster in school, I can remember sitting there. The problem that I had was not only were Mom and Dad angry and there was not enough money because we drank, you know, the money was consumed for drinking. And so we were poor, and I was unhappy. I was miserable. And I tell you this because, like Harriet, I can't stand up here and tell you that I had this great, charming life drinking alcohol and that I had a wonderful time. And then I crossed a mysterious line and became alcoholic. I was one of those people who was, I wasn't really a winner when I had my first drink. I wasn't on a roll, and I was a freeze-dried drunk. You know, when I had my first drink, I was ready. And I can't tell you what alcohol took from me, because I didn't have much going for me when I started drinking. But I'd sit in the first and second grade surrounded, and unfortunately, not only were things uncomfortable at home, but I knew what real families, what healthy families were like. And the reason I knew that is because we had a television in our home. And I knew that real moms and dads were like Ozzie and Harriet and Ward and June Cleaver and Danny Thomas. And I knew what real families were like, and we weren't like that. And so I used to sit in school and use all of my energy just to look like I came from a happy, healthy, normal, middle American home. And it was hard work. It was hard work. And I was frightened. And I was angry. I was so envious of all my classmates who came from happy homes. And I was just full of resentment. I was that tall, and I was just a bundle of resentment. You know who else I hated? I hated the Mouseketeers. I would turn on the Mickey Mouse Club, and, you know, those guys, they had it great, you know. And I knew they were in on something that I wasn't in on. And you know, today, at the age of 42, I can tell you that I feel like a Mouseketeer now. Today I'm in on something that most people out there aren't in on, and I'm really grateful for it. But I resented the Mouseketeers, and I don't remember my first drink. I don't remember the first time I ate Brussels sprouts or the first time I had pot roast, and I don't remember the first time I had a drink of alcohol in an alcoholic home. But I do remember what it did for me, and it did for me what a couple of the other speakers have described. I was scrawny. I wasn't much to look at. I was awful at sports. I was terribly insecure. I was shy. You know, it's hard, the dichotomy. Maybe some of you can relate to this. Basically, I'm still kind of a bashful person, but all I've ever wanted out of life was to stroll out on a balcony and just wave to cheering throngs, you know. Have you seen Evita? You know, I can just, I'm still waiting, but, and it would probably be a real good idea for that never to happen. I was, like I said, I was scrawny and I was shy and embarrassed and uncomfortable. And you know, when I drank, I became tall and handsome and witty and charming and urbane. Nobody was urbane in Hamilton, Ohio. I was urbane. I was everything I wanted to be. And I think almost every time I drank, I got to be tall and handsome and charming for 10, 15, 20 minutes. You know, I just felt great. Everything was okay. Everything was fine. And I don't know who drives and who navigates in your family. Usually I drive and Linda navigates, and she has the map. And just as we go past the exit, she'll go, "That was the exit." Well, that's what it was like for me to be tall and handsome and charming, you know. I always went right past it. Always went right past it. And without exception, the same person who early in the evening for 10 or 15 or 20 minutes was tall and handsome and charming was off in the corner somewhere feeling sorry for himself, feeling worse because nobody loved me. You know, when I walked into this hotel on Thursday, I knew I was among people who love me. And I know you love me because you have to. And there's a lot of comfort in that, because I may mess up this morning, but you have to love me anyway. There's a lot of freedom in that. When I was drinking, nobody loved me. I knew nobody loved me because I knew I was unlovable. I knew that I was unworthy of being loved. All in a matter of hours, it was the same chemical. Early in the evening, it made me tall and handsome, and later in the evening, it made me miserable and unlovable. When I was a senior in high school, my family disintegrated. I went to live with my grandmother. My brother Doug went to live on the streets for a while. He had a terrible, terrible heroin habit, nearly killed him. My mother and my sisters were homeless for a while. It was a terrible time, really, in all of our lives. But I wanted to go to school. And you know, when you're 17 or 18 years old, and you're not much to look at, and you're not that bright, and you don't have any money, the world doesn't just unfold unlimited opportunities, but there's always politics. So I got into politics, and I became involved in politics in my local community. And there was a fellow who kind of took me under his wing. And he ran for the legislature, and he was elected to the legislature, and he ran for Congress. And he was elected to Congress. And in 1975, I was 20, 21 years old. He took me to Washington with him as his press secretary. I think a lot of us are, you know, pretty good at spinning stories, and I was at least an average story spinner, and so I was probably qualified for the job. And I moved to Washington. I got an apartment on Capitol Hill, and I worked for him during the day, and I went to night school. I was telling Harriet this morning there were several schools in the area: George Mason, George Washington, Georgetown, American University, Catholic, Howard. The way I picked my school was from the bus schedule. I called to find out where I could go to school where I wouldn't have to transfer buses, and ended up at George Washington. So that's how I picked George Washington. So it was 1975. I weighed 110, 115 pounds, and I arrived in Washington. Because it was 1975, there was not a natural fiber in my wardrobe. I was polyester from head to toe. And I drank like a fish, and I smoked like a chimney. And how I avoided just going up in flames at some point. Those of you who smoked cigarettes and wore double-knit slacks can probably remember what happens when a live spark lands on your leg, and it's like the China syndrome, you know, that meltdown. It's like molten lead, you know, and if you're drunk, you don't even know what happened, you know. It's just, you just know something's burning, and you know, I laugh about those clothes today. Linda threw them out when we got married, but that stuff's still in a landfill somewhere, and those slacks still have a perfect crease, you know. That'll but see, the scariest thing of all was that I was full of secrets by then. I was full of secrets. My secret was I had no business being in Washington. I had no business being in a white-collar job because I was just junk from the wrong side of the tracks, and I was a drunk. And at some level, I knew there was something wrong. There was nothing wrong with me when I was 4 years old. When I was 4 years old and I thought that everything was my fault, it wasn't. There was nothing wrong with me. I was just coping as best I could at the age of four. At the age of 20, at the age of 21, 22, I was a drunk. And, you know, I don't blame that on my mom or my dad or my childhood. I'm an alcoholic, and I drank too much, and that's why I'm here this morning. And I was as phony as a $3 bill, and I was a drunk. I joined a little club on Capitol Hill because I could drink on plastic. I didn't have to carry cash with me, and so I'd go to work and I'd go to school, and then I'd go to this club and pretend I was going to have a dinner, and I'd drink. And I drank all evening. And on the weekends, I'd go to a little place. Harriet, you might remember. It was over on 13th Street. It was called Matt Cain's Bit of Ireland. And it was, that's where I drank on Friday and Saturday night. And I discovered Guinness Stout. And the wonderful thing about Guinness Stout is you always have two glasses in front of you, you know, so one can come up to room temperature. You wouldn't drink it cold, you know. You have to drink it at room temperature. So I would drink Guinness Stout. And eventually I would drink a little too much Guinness Stout. But I didn't want you to know that I'd had too much Guinness Stout. And I remember when I got here, they said, you know, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. And I remember thinking, well, any damn fool can stay sober not drinking. You know, I had no idea how that kind of information was relevant to my life. But I'm going to tell you another... If you haven't heard this, I'm going to let you in on two more secrets. I used to drink... And I'd know I'd had too much to drink, and I knew I couldn't talk, and I couldn't walk very well anymore, and I was having trouble with my reflexes and my speech. And you remember that feeling when your tongue would start to get really thick, and you're trying so... It took every ounce of energy just not to slur my words. And I could string three or four or five words together, and each one was just a pearl, you know, articulated... perfectly, and then I'd be on the fifth or the sixth word, I'd feel smug. I can talk. And then I'd realize I had no idea what the hell I was trying to say. I'd spent so, you know, devoted so much attention to trying to pronounce the words that I had no idea what I was talking about. I was pretending to be sober. If you don't drink today, tonight you will not have to pretend that you're sober. You will not have to pretend you haven't had too much to drink. Because you'll be sober. You won't have to pretend you're sober. And the other little secret, remember that those feelings in the morning? You know, when you could hear the dust settling on the furniture and I could hear the sunrise, you know? It was awful. You know what I called that? I called that getting up. You know what people in AA call that? They call that a hangover. We acquire a vocabulary here that I didn't know what social drinking was before I got here. I work with people, earth people, you know, people who have never explored alternatives to reality the way we have, and they don't go out for social drinking after work. I've never heard one of them say, let's go out and do some social drinking after hours. It's just, let's go have a drink. And they never say, I think we can handle it. That's never a discussion. Let's go have a drink. I think I can handle it. They just go have a drink. Or they don't, you know. Well, that's called, that feeling in the morning is called a hangover. And if you don't drink, you won't have hangovers. Now, just think for a moment how much your workload is cut down just by not drinking. You don't have to pretend that you're not drunk. And you don't have to cope with hangovers. It's remarkable. I mean, I promise you this morning that we will cut your workload in half. If you're thinking about drinking today and you don't do it, we can cut your workload in half. Well, what happens then when you're having trouble talking, and like I said, Matt Cain's was wonderful because there was a narrow corridor to get out to the front of the building, so you had a... it was like leaving, you know, going down a chute. I mean, you could bounce off the walls, but you could still find them. Well, you get to the point where, at least I did, got to the point where I knew that I'd had a little too much to drink and I probably wasn't sober enough to drive home. So you switch to sober up, right? Well, everybody knows coffee will sober you up. So I'd switch to Irish coffee. Now, at Matt Cain's, they serve the Irish coffee for, I think it was about $4.50 a glass. And they put it in these harp-handled milk glass mugs. They were on a little pedestal. It had a real tacky shamrock in it, I always thought maybe I would entertain sometime and that I should have a collection. And I did not steal any of the glasses here today, by the way. But I used to, when I tell you this story, you're going to know where the mugs went. So I used to drink Irish coffee to sober up to drive home. And I'd put my belt through the handles on the glasses. Now, this is somebody who needed a chute to get to the street, right? And I'd walk out to the car with all this glass around my waist, never having given any thought to whether I wanted to have a family or, how much sense it might make to. And then I'd get in the car and drive home in first gear so that the cops wouldn't pull me over. And then I would get home to my apartment, and those of you who drank Irish coffee will know what I'm talking about. I'm one of very, very few people I've ever met in this fellowship who was born after 1950 who never tried any drugs other than alcohol. But alcohol is the only drug I ever drank and only drug I ever used. And I don't really know a lot about all that stuff that they sell out there on the streets, but it is inconceivable to me that they've ever synthesized anything, created any chemical that is any more wicked than having alcohol in your blood system telling you that it's time to pass out. I mean, the room is spinning. What more evidence do you need that it is just time to pass out? And the caffeine is just coursing through your veins, you know, and your eyes are like this. And it was awful. It was just awful. And I could only do it two nights a week, Friday and Saturday. I couldn't do Irish coffee every night. But the day I moved to Washington, I remember I stopped at a liquor store on my way home and I bought a half gallon of scotch because I like scotch, and I bought a quart of bourbon and a quart of gin. And as the clerk bagged up my acquisition, he said, "You must be entertaining." And I remember at that moment admitting to myself that no, not really. I wasn't very entertaining at all, and it was not entertaining. It was grim. And that's why I'm here. I'm here because it was grim, not because it was fun. And I'm not going to regale you with a lot of drunken stories. In fact, this might be as good a place as any to mention that I think it must have been the 15th of January in 1977. It was a Saturday morning, and I'd been at Matt Cain's the night before, and I got up and I went to down to GW. I drove down on the weekend, and I was going to register for classes for the next semester. And I was crossing the street, and it was an icy morning, and I slipped on the ice, and I fell. And I was only on my back for a moment on the street, but as I was lying there, a thought came to me, and this is the miracle right here. This is the miracle. The thought came to me, I deserve better than this. Now, remember, when I was 4 and 5 years old, it was my fault that Mom and Dad were angry. It was my fault we were poor. It was my fault that they drank too much. Everything that, by the time I was 22, it was my fault. You know, the war in Vietnam, Watergate, you know, anything that had happened on my watch, it was my fault. And I thought I deserved better than this. I didn't think in that moment that I was alcoholic. But I thought there might, I was concerned that there was something wrong with my drinking, and I decided I was going to call Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went home that day, and I poured out my booze, and I quit drinking. And I don't know if I quit drinking for, was quitting for the rest of the weekend, or for the month, or for the year, or for the rest of my life. I honestly don't remember, but I remember I had decided to quit drinking. And that lasted until Sunday afternoon, when I had to go to the laundromat. And I thought about that stuff. I'd pour it out, and I went and had a couple of belts, and I went to the laundromat, and the next day I went to work. And by mid-morning, I was wondering why I had become so hysterical on Saturday that I thought I needed to call Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, in the cartoons, they have a little depiction of the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other, and they're wrestling. That's what happened to me all day, you know. One little voice said, you were supposed to call AA. And the other voice said, don't be silly, everything's just fine. And finally I relented. I thought, oh hell, I'll just do it. And I looked, got out the white pages, and I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called the desk. And a woman answered the phone, and she said, this is AA, may I help you? And I said, I want to find out something about your program. And she said, for yourself or for a friend? And I said, for me. And we got to talking for a few minutes, and it became very clear to me very early in this conversation that she and I had entirely different agendas. My idea was that she could send me some information about alcoholism and about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would read up about it. I was a college boy. I was a smart guy, you know. I was going to read up. She was thinking that if I thought there might I might have a problem with drinking, that I should meet some other people who'd had problems with drinking and who had managed to cope with their problems with drinking, and that the place that I should do that was at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we argued back and forth, and finally I relented. I didn't know when you met. I was aware, as I said, the Kiwanis I knew met once a month in the basement of the Methodist church where I grew up. I knew that where the Rotarians met. I figured maybe you met once a week or every other week or something, but you can imagine how surprised I was when she told me there was a meeting in my neighborhood that night. And I said, well, you know, I'd like to go to a meeting tonight, but I go to night school. I don't think I could make a meeting tonight. And she said, well, when is your class over? And I told her 7:30, because I didn't know any better. And she said, well, the meeting's not till 8:30. And I said, well, you know, I'd like to go to a meeting at 8:30, but my car's not running. I didn't have bourbon bumps because I drank scotch, but my car had to be steamed and pressed a few times, and it was sitting out in front of the apartment that morning with a flat tire. And I don't want you to think for a moment that my life was unmanageable, okay? Oh, that used to annoy me. You know, first of all, you know the story about the guy that goes to the doctor and the doctor says he needs his gallbladder out? And he said, well, I'd like a second opinion. And the doctor says, well, you're ugly too. Well, you know, it's bad enough to have it suggested that I was powerless over alcohol. But then, you know, that you're ugly too. You know, your life's unmanageable. And I had bought this car new. And a new car was an unusual development in my family. And I loved this car. But this car was sitting out in front of my apartment with a flat tire. And maybe some of you can understand this. I'm here today because I have an obsession with alcohol, and there's no question about it. There were several cherry tomatoes left on plates last night. I can't eat tomatoes because I'm allergic to tomatoes, and I was about that tall when I figured that out. And you know what I did? I quit. Cold turkey. I just gave it up. I don't eat tomatoes on New Year's Eve. On St. Patrick's Day. You know, if somebody else is having a cherry tomato at a wedding reception, I just leave it alone. I just don't eat tomatoes, you know. I drank alcohol, and it made me miserable. And so I thought, well, I better try this again. Right, because I have an obsession with alcohol. I still have an obsession with alcohol. I was on the elevator yesterday, and there was a Coors can sitting on the floor of the elevator, and there are four of us just being riveted, you know. My wife and I drove past a liquor store on Pennsylvania Avenue a few years ago, and there was a big sign in the window that Dewar's was on sale. And I said, look at that, honey, they've got Doers on sale. And she said, well, what the hell do you care? I cared a lot. You know, I said, it gives me a warm feeling to know there are people getting a good price on good scotch. I have an obsession with alcohol. That is not my only obsession. I have an obsession. Oh, by the way, there are professionals who have that, too. Have you read these articles about professionals trying to teach people like us how to drink? That's crazy. That's an obsession with alcohol, you know? I mean, if my parents had taken me to the doctor and said, the kid eats tomatoes and his mouth breaks out, and the doctor said, you know, I think we can teach him. I think we can teach him how to do this. I think we have a fatal illness, and for people to think they can teach us how to drink suggests to me that they have an obsession with alcohol. What is it about alcohol that is so important that social drinking would become an objective of therapy? It's just it's mind-boggling to me. It's an obsession with alcohol. I also have, and this is why I'm going to get back to this flat tire eventually. I have an obsession with justice, and specifically with Mac McKenney's idea of justice. I have an obsession with justice. It was not my fault that tire was flat, and I didn't think I should have to change it. I was going to show them. I don't know who I thought was going to change that tire. I don't know if I was waiting for somebody to knock on my door and say, we noticed your tire's flat, and I'll bet that's not your fault. Could I change that tire for you? You know. But there sat that car in front of my apartment for weeks. Not that my life was unmanageable. This was a matter of principle with a flat tire. So I told her that she said, well, I'm sorry about your car. And she said, where do you live? And I said, 5th and G. And she said, well, the meeting's at 2nd and East Capitol Street. You can walk. So she'd pinned me. So that night, and this was the 17th of January, the city was covered with ice, and the wind was howling, and it was just a nasty, icy evening in Washington. I'm convinced the only people who were out that night were drunks. You know, people were either going to bars or liquor stores or AA meetings, and I think everybody, all the Earth people were indoors. And I found this church on East Capitol Street, and there was a light in front of it, and I went up and tried the front door, and it didn't open, and I thought, well, AA's closed, and I didn't know we usually, you know, meet in the basement, and so I started back toward the street, and suddenly I saw, like a scene out of a movie, I saw this long shadow, and I looked up, and here was this very pleasant, nattily dressed man, and I said, is this where the meeting is? And he said, the AA meeting? And I looked up and down the street, you know, but I thought this was supposed to be anonymous, and I wasn't paranoid or anything, but I was scared to death my neighbors would, you know that I was getting sober. After I'd been coming to meetings a few weeks and I realized I left the apartment at the same time every night, I thought, you know, these folks are going to figure this out. And so I started leaving at different times to kind of throw them off. So they would... But anyway, he said, come on in, I want to introduce you to some guys. So we went in and he took me down to the kitchen and handed me a half a cup of coffee, and we went into an auditorium, and there was tables set up in a T formation, and there at the head of the table sat the president of Alcoholics Anonymous in a three-piece suit with a gorgeous silk tie, and he read off a laminated card, and then he said, my name's Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. And I thought, oh, don't say that about yourself. You know, he seemed like such a nice guy, and I couldn't imagine him saying such a thing. And then he said it was his first anniversary, and everybody clapped. And I thought he meant his wedding anniversary. And he started to talk, and you can imagine the horror that overcame me when I realized what kind of an anniversary he was talking about. He meant that he hadn't had anything to drink for a year. And I felt so sorry for him, you know, and it made me very thirsty just to hear about it. Very, very thirsty. And then he started, the topic that he led on was one day at a time. And the discussion started around the table. And you know, most of the other people at that table had quit drinking too. Some of them for a lot longer than him. And I felt sorry for them. And thought, gee, I hope that never happens to me. And by the time this was getting close, I didn't sit at the table because I didn't know how long you had to belong to sit at the table. I sat on a row of chairs off to the side. But about halfway through the meeting, it dawned on me that these folks had figured out that I'd never been to one of these before. And the reason that I knew that they knew was because there they sat leading these bone dry, barren, miserable lives without alcohol. And for my benefit, they were trying to let on like it wasn't that bad. And I was flattered by that, but I wasn't buying it for a minute. So eventually, one of the longest hours of my life came to a close, and we said the Lord's Prayer, and a fellow named Charlie, who'd been sober about 7 months and wanted to sponsor somebody really bad, and I was going to be it, rushed up to me, and he said, if you want what we've got, do what we do. And I looked around at what you had. And then this other old goat with one foot in a grave came up to me and he said, you're lucky to be here so young. And I'm thinking, here? You know. And then Charlie tried to sell me this book for $5. And I thought, you know, pal, I didn't just fall off a turnip truck, you know. I know about this book of the month stuff where you buy a book, and in the third and fourth generation, the books are still coming to your house, and you're still getting billed, and that's part of what I saw. And I heard all these lame slogans, you know, but I saw something else, and it unsettled me. I saw people who were comfortable, and I saw hope in your eyes. This morning, I see the God of my understanding in your eyes. I saw hope in your eyes, and that unsettled me. Charlie thought I should go to a meeting every day for 6 weeks. And what Charlie didn't seem to fully appreciate was I was a college boy, and I was pretty smart, and I didn't need to do this every day. So I decided I'd come once a week. And I audited the course. I audited the course for 3 weeks. It was miserable. The most miserable experience of my life was going to AA meetings and still drinking. I'd come on Monday, and I wouldn't drink for a couple days, and then I'd be minding my own business, and I'd get struck drunk. You know, just against my will, I was just taken drunk. This pattern repeated itself for several weeks. And one night, I got together with some friends of mine, and I decided that we were going to have dinner. And I was going to have one bottle of Guinness Stout. And halfway through the second bottle of Guinness Stout, I thought, my God, I've got what they have. And I went home to my apartment, and I became hysterical. And I was hysterical because I knew that I couldn't stand to drink the way I was drinking. I couldn't stand my life, and I knew I couldn't stop. And I knew in that moment that I was going to drink alcoholically for the rest of my life. And I watched the way my father drank, and I watched the way my mother drank. And I knew that that was my destiny, that I was going to drink that way, and I was going to feel that way for the rest of my life. And decided there was no point in going back to AA because it wouldn't work for me. I'd been to 3 or 4 meetings by then, and I knew it wouldn't work. And 2 days later, I had lunch with a woman I had just met. I worked on the House side. She worked on the Senate side. And she looked at me and she said, you know, Mac McKinney, you think you're really a smart guy, but you're not smart if you don't try it our way. You just think you're smart. And she said, why don't you come to meetings with some frequency for a while and then decide whether AA will work for you. I can't tell you where it was. I can't tell you which meeting it was, but I had a moment of truth. And I sat in a meeting, and I looked around, and I was taking an inventory, yours and mine. You know, the reason I'm sober tonight is because I accepted your alcoholism. You said you were alcoholic, and I started to respect you and admire you and envy you, and I accepted your alcoholism. And I came to believe that what worked for you might work for me. And then I decided, and this was my start on a third step, that I'd try to take some of what I was hearing between the hours of 8:30 and 9:30 home with me. And use it elsewhere in my life. It's kind of like cheating, you know, just take what you hear here and use it out there. I decided I would try that. But I remember looking around the room, I'm thinking, these people are comfortable and they're happy, and I'm miserable. And they don't drink and they come to meetings. I drink and I'm miserable. And then I was immobilized by something that maybe you're wrestling with this morning. I thought, what if I stop drinking and I'm not an alcoholic? What if I'm just here by mistake? And I had this all figured out. I would die. And at the end of my life, I'd die, and I'd get up there to the gates of heaven, and there'd be a guy there with a clipboard, and he'd say, McKenny, and I'd say, yes, sir. He'd say, you quit drinking. Yes, sir, 1977. So you didn't have to quit. I beg your pardon? You didn't have to quit. You weren't alcoholic. I was only 22 years old. I figured I might live a long time. I could live 50 or 60 years needlessly sober because it was a mistake. You know, to ask that question is to answer it. This hotel is full of people who don't need to be in this meeting right now, and I dare say that if they don't need to be here, they're not up in their rooms right now saying, what if I stop and I'm not alcoholic? I think you have to be one to ask that. That's just my opinion. So I started coming to meetings, and my life started to get better. I'd been sober 4 years, and I met a woman who, I met her when she was new. We started dating when she'd been sober almost 2 years. And we decided to get married. I don't know how long you need to be sober to get married. You need to be sober longer than 4 years or 2 years. But, you know, that was 16 years ago, and we're still married to each other. And we didn't know what we were doing. But, we have common values. There's a spiritual foundation that... when we forget why we stood in front of our friends and said that we'd stay together for the rest of our lives, when we forget why, there's a common spiritual foundation that we fall back on, and not even consciously. When we argue, we don't talk about the steps. You know, that's not my point at all. But there's a spiritual foundation that we share. And we'd been sober a few months, and my baby sister called, and she said that, and she was in high school at the time, she said that our mother had been distributing pharmaceutical products without the benefit of a license or an education, and that she, my sister, wanted to leave home. So she came to live with us. And my mother and I didn't speak for several years. My mother was so hurt and so angry that there was no contact between us for a number of years. Well, Patty, my little sister... finished high school, and we got her a nice set of Samsonite luggage for graduation, and she didn't make the connection, and she said, you know, there's this nice junior college close by. So she stayed for a while, and eventually she put herself through school on a tennis scholarship. I'm really grateful that my wife and I had the opportunity to share our home with her. I wasn't grateful at the time. I'd go to meetings and I'd piss and moan and I was waiting for my badge, you know. Nobody ever gave me a badge. I thought I was just such a swell guy for taking this kid in. And most people thought that the deal was I should just, like, you know, not drink and go to meetings and count my blessings, you know. And so she moved out, and Linda and I decided that we wanted to have children. And I'm going to tell you about something that's a little hard for me to talk about, but it's important. One day we got the wonderful news that Linda was pregnant, and after she'd been pregnant, I don't know, a couple of months, I guess, we went to the HMO that we belonged to and for a routine sonogram, and the technician seemed concerned, and he called the doctor in, and the doctor said, you know, we're not sure you're still pregnant. Let's use this sonogram as a baseline and come back in 10 days, and we'll see where we are. So we came back 10 days later and learned to our great disappointment that Linda was no longer pregnant. And the doctors said, you know, this is not a medically significant development. You should try again. So there's no reason not to try again. So we did, and we got the news that Linda was pregnant, and we were anxious, but we were happy and excited. And Linda started the show, and we'd go to meetings, and I'd pat her on the tummy, which really annoyed her. And we were really looking forward to having this child in our home. And she called me from the office one day, and she said, you better meet me at the hospital right away. Something's wrong. So I rushed down to the hospital, and the doctors examined her, listened to the baby's heartbeat, and came out and said, the water has broken, and it's too soon. And we're sorry, but this pregnancy is no longer viable. So several hours later, Linda went into labor, and she delivered a little boy. And we gave him a name, and we spent some time with him. And the doctors said, we don't know what's wrong, but there's no reason to believe that this will happen again. Why don't you try again? So several months later, Linda was pregnant again, and we were looking forward to having a child. And we had the same experience. She woke me up one morning and said, we need to go to the hospital right away. It was the same story, labor, delivery, and another little boy. And I went to a meeting. It was either later that day or the next day, and I sat next to somebody for whom God had just found a parking space. And I thought, you know, I don't understand this. And my face was shattered. My face was absolutely shattered. And I'm not here this morning to tell you that I'm grateful for those losses. I can't say that in all honesty. I'm very grateful that my face was shattered, because my face was it didn't work. I didn't. What I believed in wasn't true, and I'm glad my faith was shattered. But I was so angry at God. If you take your glasses off, you know people can't see you, or at least you're out of focus. Well, I thought that if I just withheld my faith, that I could diminish God somehow. That I'll show Him. I just don't know if I believe anymore, because I was hurt and I was angry, and I thought it was God's fault. And all I believed, the sum total of my theology at that point in my life, was I don't have to drink because I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's all I believed in. I can stay sober because I'm in AA, because my friends in AA will take care of me. And that was the beginning of a journey back. See, I believed, and this isn't in the literature anywhere, and nobody told me this. Somehow I had gotten it in this squirrely little mind of mine that if you don't drink and you pick up ashtrays and you sponsor people and you take phone calls and you... All I wanted was an A+ in AA. Every day that I've been here, I've just hoped that the maid who cleans the room on my floor would say that I had the cleanest hotel room that she picked up. You know, I wanted an A+ in AA. I was going to write the best fourth step that's ever been written. You know, I was going to be the best sponsor. I thought if you don't drink and you do what you're supposed to do, that good things will happen. I think I thought it was some kind of an insurance policy that bad things wouldn't happen. That's just not true. When I was a little child, they taught me, I learned a story in Sunday school about the wise man who built his house on a foundation of rock and the foolish man who built his house on a foundation of sand. And the rains came. You know, the guy who built the house on a foundation of rock, it rained on his house too. You know, it didn't say if you build on a foundation of rock, it's not going to rain. The rain falls on the just and the unjust alike. Like the bumper sticker says, you know, stuff happens. You know, life happens. Life happens to all of us, whether we're sober or not. I remember I'd been sober 3 or 4 months, and I got the flu, and I was furious. I thought, what is this? I'm not drinking. I'm going to meetings. Life happens. Well, I was reading... I was so pleased that last night Harriet encouraged people to start at the beginning of the big book rather than in the fifth chapter. I was reading the 12 and 12 one night, and I was reading the foreword. And it said that AA's 12 steps are a series of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the compulsion to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. Doesn't say anything about bigger cars or promotions or a bigger house or good health. It doesn't say that people you love won't hurt. It doesn't say that you'll be immune from all the heartache that everyone else in the world experiences. It says that if I practice these principles, that the compulsion to drink will leave me and that I can be happily and usefully whole. And I believe today that that's why I was put on this earth, is to be happily and usefully whole, to be of service. When I got here, if you'd said, Mac, there are two ways to get sober. One is you can strip to your waist and you can crawl on your bare belly on broken glass. Or you can hang out with people after meetings and swap phone numbers and become a part of life. I'd have chosen the broken glass. I had to become an alcoholic in order to have friends. My first sponsor said the way we stay sober is our friends help us stay sober. You know, Bill talked to Dr. Bob. You know, everyone in this room talked, you know, we talked to each other before the meeting, after the meeting, in the coffee room. That's how we stay sober. And I believe today that that's why I'm here. It's because, as I said, when I got here, I realized that I was with a bunch of people who love me. And I think that's why we're sober today. Well, this story about the family took a turn for the better. The doctors told us if we wanted to have children that maybe we should start thinking about adoption. And so we did. And on the 19th of December in 1987, we went out to Dulles International and watched a social worker walk off a plane with a little boy from South Korea. His name's Reed. Reed's 10 years old now. I call him the devil child. I don't know whose fault that is. And 2 years later, we went out to Dulles, and a volunteer walked off the plane with a little girl. Her name's Nora, and she's 8. They're 8 and 10 years old now. And they're a handful, and they're a blessing. They're the most wonderful thing that could happen in anyone's life. A week ago, my wife Linda and our daughter Nora picked me up at the subway, and it's about a 5-minute ride home, and in the course of 5 minutes, Nora had asked me, what does it mean to have sex with your boyfriend? How does the baby get out of the mommy's tummy? How could you have a baby if you weren't married in the first place? Why didn't her birth mother keep her? Couldn't someone have helped her birth mother keep her? Do I drink? Why don't I drink? Did I used to drink? And what happened when I drank? This was a 5-minute ride home. I'm 42 years old. I've been sober 20 years, and I am not old enough, and I am not sober enough to be this child's father. But she is a blessing. And I'm going to tell you something else that's happened in my life recently because I think it's important. You remember I asked, I was talking about dying and maybe finding out I was an alcoholic. I do remember sitting here one night, and again, I was confronted with the same thing. You were comfortable and I was miserable, and you were comfortable because you were at peace with a power greater than yourselves, and I was still angry. And I looked around the room and I thought, what if all this God stuff, what if it's all just a bunch of nonsense, you know? And you die, and when you die, you're just as dead as your dog when your dog dies. You know, that's the end of the run. And the whole spiritual thing was just nonsense. I thought, you know, if I practice these principles in all my affairs, I could spend the rest of my life needlessly happy, needlessly whole, and needlessly serene. Well, I mentioned a little earlier that my mother and I, there was a lot of distance between us after my sister came to live with us. I've prayed a lot about that over the years. And it's hard for me when people tell me to pray for people I'm angry at. And I remember learning, I can't tell you how stunned I was when I learned, it talks in the 11th step about praying for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. That's all I have to pray for anybody else. I don't have to pray that to get a raise or a big car, you know. I just have to pray for God's will for them. And I started praying for my mother. My mother and I experienced a healing. There's healing in these rooms. We experienced a healing in our relationship early this year, just after the first of the year. And it wasn't a big dramatic production. We just talked and everything was okay between us. And I'm so grateful. My mother was 63. And about 7 weeks ago, I got a call that she'd had a brain aneurysm. I'm sorry, did I say seven? She was 63. She had a brain aneurysm and she was very sick and she probably wouldn't live and that I needed to come home. And when I went home, she was lucid. And we did not need to experience a reconciliation when she was on her deathbed because we had reconciled. Everything was okay between us. And I'm so grateful for that. And I have all of you to thank for that. That would never have happened if I didn't have the disease of alcoholism, if I hadn't shown up at these meetings and listened to what you've had to tell me. My mother died about 3 weeks later, and it was okay. She never got sober, but my mother has been given release from her alcoholism. And I believe that right now my mother is okay, and that she knows that I'm okay. And that for the first time, she knows why I'm here and why I'm standing in front of you. And that means the world to me. And I thank you all for that. I'm going to close with something. I am going to close. I start off kind of slow, but it does build to a finish. And I'm going to close with something that's not conference-approved literature, but it means a lot to me. If you've ever read the book, the play J.B. by Archibald MacLeish, it's based on the book of Job. And you know, J.B.'s wife was pretty smart. And when he'd lost everything, she turned to him and she said, "You wanted justice, didn't you?" That's me. I have an obsession with justice. She said, "Well, there isn't any." She said, "The candles in churches are out. The stars have gone out in the sky. Blow on the coals of the heart, and we'll understand by and by." I believe that's why we're sober this morning, because what we do here is we blow on the coals of the heart. And I thank you for loving me when I couldn't conceive of why you would even care about me. And I thank you for keeping me sober.